live from the Irma Bird Center and the Beckley, West Virginia campus of Concord University. It's time for another PRISM West Virginia American History Chat featuring Dr. Bill O'Brien and Professor Keith Lilly. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Bill O'Brien and Professor Keith Lilly, only on the Horn.
Good evening, and good evening, everyone. Welcome to our program. If you're like me, you're still recovering from Thanksgiving, but I've been recovering for about 45 years, actually, and I haven't quite made it yet. But, Keith, good to see you.
Good to see you, sir.
Before we get too far, I want to introduce a guest we have with us tonight. This is Michael Curry. I'm going to let him introduce himself, but Michael and I are friends from a long time ago. 15 years, maybe, Michael? 15 years. And neither one of us have aged a bit since we first knew each other. But Michael's going to help us out this evening, and I want to give Michael a chance to say hello and introduce himself and talk about a special program that he wants to make everybody aware of this evening. So, Michael, take it away.
Well, thanks for having me, Bill. I appreciate it, Keith. The event that I would just like to point out, especially for those of you who are in the immediate area of Raleigh County, on Monday, December 5th, 2011, at the Tamarack Conference Center in Beckley, New River is going to be bringing in a guest speaker, a lady by the name of Enos Khalaf. She is a Fulbright scholar, and what makes it interesting is she has spent the bigger part of her life growing up in a Palestinian refugee camp, and she's going to be sharing her experiences with the greater Beckley community. And anybody wants to come, you can come. It's free. It'll begin at 7 o'clock in the evening on December 5th. That's Monday evening.
Great. Excellent. And Michael, if you don't mind, before we launch you, whatever that means.
I thought the seat was a little springy.
Bring our enrolled teachers up to date on some of the assignments and the syllabus for each course and those kinds of issues very briefly. But we've gotten a few emails, so let me begin with the Pillars of Principle course, the course on the founding. As you know, the syllabus says that the first assignment, which is two essays, which is at the end of the syllabus, two of the essays there are to be submitted by December 2nd, which is obviously this week. And we've gotten, I won't say a number of requests, but four or five probably, from our teachers wanting to know if they could have a little bit of extra time. And the answer is yes, by all means. The main thing I want to have them by is by the time the holidays arrive. So before we go into the vacation period, I want to have these essays so that I can read them over the vacation and return them when we get back together again after New Year's. So, you know, a week, 10 days, you know, whatever you need to do the job that we know you're capable of doing, by all means, take it. Just send the essays in. As you can either submit them on Blackboard or you can attach them to an email to me or to Margaret, either one. O'Brien@concord.edu or mramsey@concord.edu. Let me respond to one email we got which raised questions about my syllabus in the principles course. And the question was raised because of all the reflective questions, so-called reflection questions that I had put in there. In the syllabus, I talked about issues like governance in talking about the colonial period prior to independence, talking about governance, the relations between mother countries and colonies, the issues of the laws and whether the laws are equally applied and equally enforced, those kinds of issues. Then I asked questions about the geographic differences between North American colonies of Great Britain and the Southern colonies of Great Britain, as well as the differences between the Eastern and the Western parts of the colonies within each colony itself. Also, the issue for Britain in terms of how to manage its colonial empire, issues related to people's value system in terms of the way they looked at the world, how they looked at issues like freedom and natural rights and all of these issues. The whole question of rights is going to become a big issue at the time of independence. So it's very important to look at the way that colonial Americans understood the issues of individual rights. But these questions in the syllabus are all reflection questions. In other words, what I want you to do is think about these as you begin your reading. Because when you do select the essays that you want to answer, which are at the end of the syllabus, that your essays ought to reflect the fact that you have thought through some of these issues, some of these rather conflicting issues that may seem, at least on the surface, somewhat contradictory amongst different people and different groups of people in terms of religion, in terms of the way they looked at the afterlife, whether they believed in God, whether they believed in one God or more than one God, whether they didn't believe in God, whether they were Quakers or whether they were Anglicans or whether they were Congregationalists or Baptists or Methodists or whatever. The questions themselves begin on page 10 of the syllabus, where under the heading Unit 1 Assignment Presented. And here I've put a series of essay questions, and they are in italics. And you ought to select two of these. And I won't go through all the questions but at this point. But, you know, the first question relates to the issue of rights. The second question deals with the quote by John Adams about whether the revolution was effected before the war even began. And the revolution, as Adams said, was more in the minds and hearts of the people than it was anywhere else. The third question asks you to put yourself in Lord North's ministry and solve the relationship between mother countries and colonies as best you can. And then the fourth question deals with the issue of republicanism, and that's going to get you directly into Gordon Wood's book, Radicalism of the American Revolution. And so you want to take two of those questions. But again, I would look at the reflection questions, which raise some of the issues that I think ought to arise during your reading. So again, we want your essays to suggest or to be reflective and to indicate that you've taken time to think through some of these controversial issues. Remember, the assumption is that you have a textbook, so you have a general overview of the period. And then you've got specific assignments and specific primary documents related to the questions that we've asked. So you want to tie the appropriate documents to the appropriate question. And again, while the due date is December 2nd, which is, I believe, Friday, take the time you need. Just, you know, if you need an extra week or whatever, please feel free to take it. And just do the best you can. Remember, the purpose of this is a learning experience for all of us. So please don't feel that you can't submit it until you feel that it is absolutely perfect. Because if you think that, as I have many times, it never is perfect. And you always are reluctant to send it. Just do the best you can. And we'll kind of go on. And hopefully, as we work through this course and the 19th century course that Keith's working on, and then the courses to come, we'll basically be able to reflect. As we go, we're going to reflect experience and progress, and you'll become more comfortable with these kinds of questions. I realize, and Keith's going to talk a little bit about the 19th century course in a second. But I'm very aware that the questions that we've asked are really thought questions, and they aren't questions that have right and wrong answers, whereas some of the reflection questions are. I mean, most of us have an opinion on most of those. I realize that. But what I'm saying is think about these things and recognize that they did play a role in the way people looked at their lives during that period, the way they identified problems, the way they defined problems, and the way they conjured up solutions to problems. So, and again, if you are having any questions or any problems, please don't hesitate to contact me, Margaret, Keith, or all three of us. We're all at Concord.edu. I'm O'Brien. He's R.K. Lilly, and Margaret is M. Ramsey. And we're all at Concord.edu. So feel free to ask questions. Don't be shy. Please don't worry about what we'll think by the nature of the question you ask. If you have questions, you can be sure that there are other people out there that have the same questions. Keith, let me turn it over to you quickly.
A couple of housekeeping matters, first of all, having to do with the Blackboard page. One thing we can do tonight, and I think that we can do in future chats, is our teachers can use the chat room that we have in the Blackboard page to actually ask questions, maybe interact more directly with us. And so I'm logged on there right now, so if you want to go ahead and you can get in that room, if you have any questions for us or any comments to make, you can feel free to type those in. I will see those, and I will, of course, acknowledge that. Also, mramsey@concord.edu. You can email her with any questions or comments you have. And we can, of course, receive questions in that fashion as well. And that especially is important for those outside of the PRISM project and we love to hear from you. We heard from some of you last time, and we really enjoy knowing that this is going out somewhere even beyond southern West Virginia. And so anyone who wants to participate in any way like that, make sure you send your questions, your comments. Get involved in this. We'd be more than happy to try to answer your questions, right, or to maybe try to find a place where you can get that question answered or direct you to somewhere where you can maybe get the information that you need. In terms of also the Blackboard page, I want to point out that Fisk, the critical period in American history, that the link to that is on the page. I put the link on there. That's from Project Gutenberg, and so that's free. You can click it on there. You can read it online. You can download it on your Kindle with or without images,
right,
by the way, off of the Project Gutenberg. I have it on my Kindle. I think you have it on yours.
Right.
If we can put it on a Kindle, you can. I guarantee
it. I'm telling you.
I can guarantee it.
I mean, all you do is contact Kindle and wait a couple of minutes, and you got
there
the book.
There it is. And you can put it right in there. It's free.
And I would tell you that I mentioned last time, the table of contents to John Fisk's book literally takes you through page by page and tells you what every single page contains. So the table of contents is the best outline. If you took and went through and made your own outline of every page in that book, you couldn't be more complete than John Fisk was. So it's a beautiful resource, and it's free.
It's a great book. It's published in 1888, but it still has a lot to say, especially
right.
about diplomacy during the American Revolution, and especially, I think, the situation in terms of British politics.
Yeah.
The first chapter on that is just incredible, in which he talks about all the different factions within the British politics at that time and how they play.
Right.
Into the decisions concerning the Treaty of Paris.
And what we want you to do, you're not going to we're not going to ask you multiple choice questions or true or false questions about the details of British politics or anything like that. But what we want you to do is just spend a little time and read it and realize the kinds of things that were going on in England, and then realize that this is where the decisions were being made related to how to manage the colonies. And when you begin to think about that, you begin to see how what happened. And so that's really the point, is to spend more time thinking about what you read rather than concentrating and memorizing pieces of information which are not really relevant. And it's pretty obvious from the questions that I've put in there that we're not asking you for specific pieces of information. We're asking you for links and connections of the way things connect to other things and those kinds of things. And so basically what we're hoping that you will do as a result of this is not only become a little bit more familiar with the period and the content of the period, but also just begin to think in more global terms about some of the issues. Believe me, as history teachers, it will improve
yes,
the way your classroom goes.
I remember several years ago, I was teaching History 102, and I was doing a series of lectures actually on German unification, Bismarck, and German unification. And I had a student tell me after class that she didn't realize that anything was going on anywhere in the world while the American Civil War was taking place. And, you know, like it all happens in a vacuum, but it doesn't. Right? No, it doesn't happen in a vacuum at all. And so American history is just part of a much broader story. And so that certainly,
right.
Certainly is something to think of in terms of every topic that you could deal with in American history. There is some kind of international factor
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
So that's on there. We have Fisk on there. Also, I created a folder for our previous chats, and so you can go into that folder and find links for the previous chats. I just tried to clean the page up a little bit. We had too much stuff all over the place.
Right.
Also, Unit 2 for the 19th Century course is also there as well. I put it on there today. We entitled that Sectionalism, Slavery, and Secession. I did a little alliteration. I've been ribbed about that a little bit here tonight, but that's all right. It was better than my first unit, Michael. My first unit was Age of Jackson. I ripped off Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., and so I decided that sectionalism, slavery, secession, that sounds good, and so I went with that. I have the assignments for Howe and McPherson, which should give us ample background on the period from, let's say, 1815 to 1861, beginning of the war. This one is due on January 30th. What I really want to do is make sure that I can fit in all four units. And so in order to do that, I'm going to have to contract this one a little bit. I want to concentrate mostly on the third unit, which will deal with the war itself, the period during the war. And then the last unit will deal with Reconstruction. And so the due date here is January 30th. You also have your document assignments as well. That's all laid out for you. If you have any questions about that, make sure you let us know. It's the same kind of criteria in terms of the essay. Now, remember, with the founding course, you write two essays. With the 19th century course, you write one essay for each unit because you're doing the larger research project that we have as part of the course. All right, so don't forget that. Of course, that's all laid out. I say choose one. One's in bold print. So that
and you've
that
got
should
five
be,
beautiful choices. The
and
questions
I have
are superb.
Very open-ended. But one of the choices is about William Lloyd Garrison, and we're going to talk about that in a minute.
Right.
In fact, that's really why I wanted to have Michael with us this evening. I have a question about John C. Calhoun and William Seward in terms of the compromise, debate over the compromise of 1850. You have documents for that. One about the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and I want to say something about that. With every one of these questions, I have a suggested secondary reading list, right? A very short list of books that you might consult. For the most part, these books are books that you can acquire from the Concord Library. And we have an excellent relationship with Dr. Rao in the library, and so you can have access to
you
those
have
books.
Faculty privileges at yes. Concord's library.
So,
which means you can take a book out and keep it out for the entire semester, I think it is.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's something that I kept in mind. So many of the books that I have listed as suggested secondary readings, they are from Concord Library. There are a few that are older books, not unlike with Fisk, that you can acquire online, mainly through archive.org. And if you can get something from archive.org and read it online, you can generally also put it on your Kindle.
Right.
And we know you all have Kindles, so you can do that. But I wanted to say something else that I don't have written here about the Lincoln-Douglas debates question. If you go to the C-SPAN website, back in the 1990s, and you gentlemen may know this, back in the 1990s they did reenactments of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. You remember that? You watched
yes,
some
I
of
do.
They were great. Some of them were better than others. So different actors in terms of different locations. Those are archived on C-SPAN. I was thinking, that might be a good source for you to help you with the Lincoln Douglas debates if you choose that particular topic in terms of writing an essay for this unit. It also might be something that would be useful in classrooms, in terms of trying to kind of bring the Lincoln Douglas debates to life. So you might want to look for that. I mean, I might make a point of actually finding it on the C-SPAN site. I just kind of thought about it today and maybe making a link for us so that you can make use of those. Because the interesting thing with the Lincoln Douglas debates, I mean, I have a link to transcripts, I guess you might say, or to these speeches, but there are different versions. And so you can find different versions of what was said, from different sources. Those of you who are in the Beckley area, if you go to Ollie's, Ollie's has some paperback editions of Lincoln Douglas debates, and there's editorial notes and things like that. That are, it's like $4.99 or something. And so you might want to look at that. I mean, I realize that of all of these options, Lincoln Douglas debates is probably one that you're probably going to teach. And so it's obviously one that, I would, kind of say that kind of thing for. And so these are some resources you might could use in terms of the Lincoln Douglas debates. We also have a question on the Declaration of the Causes of Secession, and I give you links to that as part of the readings. I have some suggested readings. William C. Davis's The Government of Our Own is not a book that's in the Concord Library, but it is. When it comes to the founding of the Confederacy, I don't think there is a better book. Emory Thomas' Confederate Nation is not too far behind it. But all of those documents available online. I certainly would encourage anyone who has any doubts about why secessionists decided to leave the Union in 1860 and 1861, to look into those documents. They tell us in 1860 and 1861 why they're leaving the Union. It's not the same thing they say in 1880 and 1881, but they tell us back in 1860 and 1861 why they're leaving the Union. We might look at those at some point this evening, if we have the time, but I really want to kind of focus on Garrison. Also, I have a question about the Confederate Constitution, and I thought that maybe someone might want to compare and contrast the Confederate Constitution with the United States Constitution. There are a lot of similarities, many, many similarities. Clearly, the United States Constitution is the model for the Confederate Constitution, but the changes are important. Just one, for example, no general welfare clause in the Confederate Constitution, not there. They're not forming a more perfect union. They're forming a more perfect government, right? There's differences in terms of what they're conveying in the Confederate Constitution, and also in terms of interpretation of that. I have the Stevens Cornerstone speech from Savannah, Georgia, in March of 1861, as one of our documents, and Jefferson Davis's inaugural address in 1861, in which he certainly refers to the framers, and so that's the reason I included both of those documents. Finally, I don't want to use up too much time here. Finally, there is a question on the secession commissioners. And in two of the questions, I also recommend that you use a Confederate catechism as a foil. And Confederate catechism is basically a treatise written by a lost cause apologist. I think it was published in the late 19th century, and basically arguing slavery has nothing to do with secession, had nothing to do with why we fought the war and things of that nature. And you can kind of use that as a foil to a large degree. But this last question is about the secession commissioners. As the initial deep southern states secede from the Union after the election of Lincoln, and they issue those declarations of the causes of secession to tell us why, they sent commissioners to slave states that had not seceded from the Union yet. And these commissioners were going to convince the state legislatures and the governors of other slave states to leave the Union, try to get them to secede. They sent someone to Virginia. They sent someone to Kentucky. They sent someone to Maryland to try to get them to secede from the Union, to kind of persuade them. And you have a website, which I've given you as part of the document assignments, which has documents from all the secession commissioners. Okay? This is speeches that they're primarily giving to state legislatures. And what they would do is they would find someone, like if someone's from Mississippi, they find someone who had roots in Virginia, you know, who was born in Virginia or had relatives in Virginia, and they would send them to Virginia and get them to make the speech before the state legislature or before the secession convention is meeting in Richmond at that particular point, to try to convince them to vote for secession. You have all the documents there. And one book I recommend, and I don't think this is in the Concord Library, but I think I showed it to everybody over the Academy last summer, but you might want to lay your hands on this. This is Apostles of Disunion by Charles Dew, published by the University of Virginia Press. And this is about the secession commissioners. He even has a couple of documents in the book as well. I know he has the Harris speech to the I think the Georgia legislature, and he has I think one of the letters, like the Hail letter to the governor of Kentucky. And this is a great book about why secessionists wanted to secede from the Union, and the idea that if we really want to know that, let's look and see what secessionists said. Right? Let's not. And what they said in 1860 and 1861 when they're actually leaving the Union. So that, I think, is a very provocative set of documents. They're shocking in some ways, the way some of the secession commissioners, of course, are saying that the Republicans will not only destroy slavery, they will bring on racial equality, there will be degradation throughout the South, you know, and some of them even expressed the idea that it would be better, you know, for us to go down in flames fighting for the entire population to be completely destroyed. Sherman almost tried to make that a fulfilled promise, rather than, you know, rather than submit to what they perceived as the rule of the abolitionist party, right? I mean, both sides, North and South, have this sense of conspiracy, right? That the other side has a conspiracy to control the government, to make sure that their interest is met rather than the other one. So if you're going to look at that option, the secession commissioners, that's something a lot of people don't really talk much about. It's barely mentioned in even some of the general histories, even the better general histories of the Civil War, such as McPherson. That's something that I would very much encourage you to look at. We used it, in fact, for our upper-level course here for Concord, for the Civil War course, and students reacted to it an interesting way. Some of them, I think I told you, some of them said that they thought the Confederate Catechism was used as well, that it was a more persuasive argument because one student just flat out wrote this because it fits my belief system. Right? When I was floored. Yeah. Right? So don't do that. Right. If you want to say which argument's better,
make a case.
Even though I know that there are still plenty of would-be secessionists around, please remain objective at all possible.
Rick Perry may be one of them.
Right. Yeah. That's not something we need to get into at this particular point. Do you have any other housekeeping matters?
Just one reaction to what you said. Keep in mind that what you're going to find as you work through these essay questions that are in Unit 2 in the 19th century course on secession and slavery, keep in mind the extent to which each side tries to ground itself in the thinking and the ideals of the founders. Because obviously how successful they are in doing that throws the burden of responsibility for secession on the other side. Mm-hmm. You know, the more they're able to persuade you that what they're doing is perfectly consistent with the founding and with the Declaration and with the Constitution and everything else. You know, just as the American colonies, Jefferson basically tried in the Declaration to paint the war as something the colonists were forced to do, and that ultimately the aggressor, the perpetrator of wrong in all of this, was Mother England. It was not the colonies. The colonies were merely upholding their rights as Englishmen.
Well, the Declaration of Causes of Secession is based on the Declaration of Independence. So they're basically, you know, using that model, and they're saying, you know, this is what the North has done.
Right.
The North has agitated.
And so
over
the Union is the aggressor from the
right.
perspective of the South. And of course, Lincoln's argument is that he's fighting the war to preserve the Union. So everybody basically is trying to justify their position around the basis of the founders. That's why this whole issue of how you wrestle with the founding is really significant.
That fits in so well also with the Calhoun and Seward assignments over the Compromise of 1850, because what Calhoun essentially argues is, and this really, really is similar to some of the things we heard from Gordon Wood back in October. Calhoun argues that when the Union was first created, there was equilibrium. There was equilibrium between the North and the South. And in essence, the power structure has altered. What he's talking about is, you know, the growth in terms of population. In the House of Representatives, the North, the free states, you know, are obviously going to have more and more voice because their population is going to be greater. That's why it's so important to try to maintain a balance in terms of free states and slave states, because what you do is you maintain an equilibrium in the Senate. Every time a new state enters the Union, then that the debate is it going to be a free state or a slave state, because that will be that many senators sitting in the United States Senate. That's why, you know, Southerners have an interest in maybe acquiring Cuba. If we acquire Cuba, then we can cut Cuba up into three states. That's six senators. Six extra senators. And that's important in terms of every other debate they might have in terms of tariffs or anything of that nature. It's all tied into one thing. Slavery is a complex issue because it has economic aspects, it has political aspects, and it has moral aspects. And so it's a very, very complex issue. And so that really kind of fits into that. Everyone is going to claim, or almost everyone, is going to claim to be good sons of the framers, good sons of the founders. Somebody has to be right. Somebody has to be wrong. But that ended up how we're going to prove that is actually going to be on the field of battle. It's actually going to be during the war itself. All that I think is very important to keep in mind. I will point out I was going to talk about it a little more extensively, but I don't want to take too much time from Michael here. We might be able to come back, but I will point out that I used the fire bell in the night speech from Jefferson in the very opening of Unit 2. And something is kind of interesting. He's talking about how he's concerned about drawing a line, the Missouri Compromise line, the 36-30 line, and how that's not going to solve the issue. But he also makes a statement about slavery. He makes a statement about how he would be willing to get rid of slavery. He talks about slavery as being like waking up with a wolf by the ear, right? You know, you neither hold nor do you want to let go. It's not safe. He says, but as it is, we have the wolf by the ear, and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. The idea, kind of like that slavery is, it's bad that we have it, right? It's a necessary evil. Something really shifts, I think, especially in the 1830s and 1840s, in terms of how Southerners approach the defense of slavery. That framing generation, if you read people like Jefferson, somebody like Washington, they see it as a necessary evil. They're not sure how they could adjust, they don't see a real alternative. But the generation of John C. Calhoun see slavery different, and here's a quote from Calhoun. He says he sees slavery as a positive good, right? It is the ideal situation as far as he's concerned. He says, but I take a higher ground to hold it that in the present state of civilization, where two races of different origin, distinguished by color and other physical differences as well as intellectual, brought together, the relation now existing in slave-holding states between the two is instead of evil, a good, a positive good. And he sees it as, and of course, here's something that also kind of a connection with Gordon Wood's lecture in October. He's talking about the use of history. He's talking about how history bears this out. And you can almost, I mean, these people are very familiar with the classical world, with Rome and with Greece. And obviously, the Greco-Roman world is a world of slavery, just as much as their world was. And I think that that's something that Gordon Wood pointed out, that their influence, the influence of classical ideas, Aristotle's ideas in particular, about slavery is very important in that sense. That Calhoun felt compelled to defend slavery in this fashion, and that other Southerners would feel compelled to defend slavery in this fashion, tells us that someone was attacking slavery in a very profound fashion. And one of those individuals was definitely William Lloyd Garrison, right? And that's the reason we have Michael Curry with us.
William Lloyd Garrison?
Yeah, almost. Right. And I'll tell you, Bill, the reason why I really wanted Michael to come out tonight, and we both know him. We've known him for quite some time. He's a good friend of ours. He is assistant dean for the Beckley campus of New River Community and Technical College. And I know that for Constitution Day, he did a presentation on William Lloyd Garrison and Garrison's view of the Constitution. And so when I heard that, my mind started to work, and maybe I should do that. I don't know. My mind started to work, and I said, well, we need to get Michael Curry to maybe come and talk about William Lloyd Garrison. But, Michael, if you'd tell them a little bit about your background, and let's kind of get into Garrison. I think it would be great.
How well did you know him?
You did spend time in New England.
Yeah, it's gray hair. No, I actually first got interested in Garrison when I was living in Boston, going to Harvard graduate program up there, and had some acquaintance with some of his writings and speeches prior to that time. But the longer I was there, you just can't help but begin to sense the places and the things that he encountered during that time. You know, I was struck listening to Keith talking about everybody wants to be a friend of the founder or seen in positive light of the founders.
Which is still true.
I think it's safe to say that William Lloyd Garrison was not one of those people.
No.
He resoundingly distanced himself from the horrible compact, as he called it, the compromise that was made, largely over slavery, but other things as well. In the Constitution Day presentation, I actually tried to dress in character to some extent and speak first person, because it's one thing to speak about a character like William Lloyd Garrison, and many people have written wonderful things and insightful analysis. It's a whole different ball game when you encounter his words. I was telling Bill before we started today that, in my opinion, and I'm no rhetorical expert by any means, but in my lay opinion at least, I would put Garrison in the top three or four orators in United States history. I think certainly in his power of linguistics, he's second in my book only to Mary Daly of liberation theology and feminist theology circles. His words have a way of being more provocative than even those who wanted to be provoking managed to create. But one of the things I wanted to say about him, and I think it's important to realize, is Garrison himself evolved over a period of time. We look back upon that time now and his radical abolitionist work, and we sort of have this frozen picture of him at the end of his career, just before the 13th Amendment is ratified and put into action. But the truth of the matter is, I understand his career correctly, he really did evolve from a much more moderate position earlier on in his life when he was working with like Benjamin Lundy and with the paper entitled The Genius of Universal Emancipation. Humility was not high on their list at that juncture, I don't think. But at that time in his career, Garrison was still sort of working through the issue. He always had a basic gut sense that this was not right, but how to solve it didn't. He was sort of with the wolf by the ear at that juncture. Later on, as he moved from a more moderate position to a more aggressive position, he began to, well, he affiliated with some of the Back to Africa movements, that the answer to the slave question was to provide transportation for these slaves so that they might re-inhabit Africa. That very quickly began to seem to play into the hands of some of the people that Garrison would not have agreed with.
Henry Clay?
Amongst others. Yeah. Clay certainly one of the more vociferous. And so he quickly then began to evolve much more into the sort of hardcore radical stance that we remember him by today. At each juncture, as he made these progressive steps, however, he was unashamed to turn upon his former allies at that particular prior stage and castigate them with unmitigated vengeance. These were people that a month, 2 months, 3 months before he was sitting down with strategizing with and agreeing with their position. And once he made that move to the next more radical stage, he took no prisoners. He held no loyalties to his old friends, and this would later haunt him in his twilight years. A lot of the old friends that he had completely burned those bridges, and it took a near calamitous encounter with some of them at a suffrage meeting, of all places, before he could build some of those bridges back. I mentioned that it's one thing to talk about, it's another thing to hear him, and I just wanted to share just the opening statement that that Garrison made, and I'll do it as best justice as I can, but I have no doubt that he was much more powerful than I could be. But if you listen to the words of this, this is amazing. This was on the 4th of July in 1844 at a gathering where folks were expecting to celebrate the Constitution. The purpose of the meeting was to do that. And when Garrison took the podium, his words, well, they were shocking at best. Hear then the words of Garrison. There is much declamation about the sacredness of the compact which was formed between the free and slave states on the adoption of the Constitution. A sacred compact? Forsooth! We pronounce it the most bloody and heaven-daring arrangement ever made by men for the continuance and protection of a system of the most atrocious villainy ever exhibited on earth. Yes, we recognize the compact, but with feelings of shame and indignation, and it will be held in everlasting infamy by the friends of justice and humanity throughout the world. It was a compact formed that the sacrifice of the bodies and souls of millions of our race for the sake of achieving a political object, an unblushing and monstrous coalition to do evil that good might come. You'll notice in that sentence there, he said, millions of our race. I still am amazed when I talk to my students about this particular speech. He speaks of the human race, not race in terms of ethnicity. So his assumption, even in his attack on this compromise, is that we are really in equality. And he sees this as a horrible breach of the very principles that are written into the Declaration of Independence. And he really raised the bar, as it were. As he concluded that particular diatribe, and it goes on at great length, and it gets even better, he even suggests that the compromise that is struck by maintaining free and slave states dethrones God. It is such an affront to all that is holy, just, and right. At the end of it, then, he, with great dramatic bravado, lifts a copy of the Constitution up and ignites it in front of the crowd. A theatrical moment that is seldom matched in American history, in my opinion. The other thing I want to say about Garrison, and then we can talk a little bit, as he progressed in this stage from moderation to radical abolitionist, he was caught in a vortex of a historical moment when, in New England, you had the thriving transcendentalist movement, a movement that was embracing deism and the powers of reason over against revelation, that spirituality that understands that logic and reason can inform one of concepts of the divine good, and at the same time being surrounded by people who were coming from a very different theological perspective, the Quakers, many of whom, Lundy was one, these Quakers who had a different understanding of spirituality, this inner light, this inner dignity that was really, I think, the key motivator in much of Garrison's thought. The assumption that all of us have an inner light, that divine spark that, if nourished, can bring us to our full potential, I think is what he saw the entire institution of slavery denying. As such, Garrison's quest against slavery was really a holy crusade. It took on a kind of spiritual dimension that lifted it far above just normal New England politics or American politics in the colonies at the time. So I've been talking too much.
That's fine.
No, it's great.
One of the things I was going to say it earlier, and it's still quite appropriate, just in terms of the passage you read. I've noticed it during these chats when we put a document up on the screen. It's one thing to sit here and read a document. It's another thing to hear the document. And I, as teachers, you know, some of the people who are enrolled in this, who are our teachers, it's very important many times to do that, what you did, which is to read these primary sources aloud. Because what you'll find is that even your weaker readers, the students who have difficulty reading, and more, not so much reading words, but comprehending what they read, can comprehend what they hear. And they can participate. They can become full participants in the kinds of discussions that all of us as teachers want to see happen in our classroom. And the way to bring it off is to hear it. And I remind you, because you all have Kindles, that Kindles provide the opportunity to listen to the words as well as look at the words. You can read the text while you hear the words being read to you aloud. And for the weaker readers, that is just a godsend. It really is, to actually be able to hear. And these words just come alive and jump off the page. And I've seen it. I mean, I'll sometimes have read the same paragraph 15, 20 times. And we put it on that screen. And I read it because I want to make the point during our chats. And when I hear it, I see things in there that I didn't see before. You know, and I really believe that it's a key to understanding and relating to these things. So your reading was very, very powerful in a lot of ways. And the question that I had was the issue of our race. That was a question that I had. And obviously, by presuming that we're all part of the human race and that racial differences are really no differences at all, are really non-differences, then the whole idea of the racial justification for the institution of slavery disappears. If you buy into that, that more important than the rate than the color difference between the races is the fact that we are all part of one race, the human race. Once you buy into that, none of the pro-slavery arguments based on
making
race
sense
or anything else makes sense. And so when you read somebody like Garrison, once you realize that that's what he believes, this whole document becomes much more meaningful.
I think you make a great point in the sense that this document, like so many of the ones that we use in both of these courses, are documents that originally were written to be heard. And one thing I do, for example, and it's kind of a little off topic, but like if I'm going to use FDR as a source in a course, I don't want them to read it. I don't want them to read the fireside chat. I want them to hear it. Mm-hmm. I want them to hear how FDR delivered, because that's really what it was about. The content was actually, in some ways, less important than how he delivered it. And so that's you know, something that we don't have that advantage for the 19th century, but the fact that they've delivered their speeches in passionate ways is so important. And so that's a kind of a method or a technique that, you know, everyone should be encouraged to use in terms of teaching.
And, you know, probably one of the most difficult genres to understand is poetry. Mm-hmm. And once you realize that poetry was written to be heard, not to be read.
Right.
Once you realize that only by hearing poetry does poetry really jump off the page and become alive, can you really appreciate poetry. It's not everybody that can read intensely enough to understand the nuances and the connections on the written page. But once you hear it, a different skill kicks in. And once you begin to parlay that, and you did it. You did it this evening, Michael, and I appreciate that very much.
I'm going to do it again. I want to finish this first paragraph. This guy is starting on a roll, but just try to imagine the audience. Again, they're gathered to celebrate the Constitution, and they're hearing this diatribe. And Garrison goes on, he says, "No body of men ever had the right to guarantee the holding of human beings in bondage. Who or what were the framers of our government that they should dare confirm and authorize such high-handed villainy, such flagrant robbery of the inalienable rights of man, such a glaring violation of all the precepts and injunctions of the gospel? Such a savage war upon a sixth part of our whole population. They were men like ourselves, as fallible, as sinful, as weak as ourselves. By the infamous bargain which they made between themselves, they virtually dethroned the Most High God and trampled beneath their feet their own solemn, heaven-attested declaration that all men are created equal, and endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They had no lawful power to bind themselves or their posterity for 1 hour, for 1 moment, by such an unholy alliance. It was not valid then. It is not valid now. Still, they persisted in maintaining it, and still do their successors, the people of Massachusetts, of New England, and of the 12 free states, persist in maintaining it. A sacred compact. A sacred compact. What then is wicked and ignominious?
There's a tremendous irony there, in a sense that he's talking about the Constitution being nullified, right? That it's null and void. When you think about that in light of nullification theory, Southern nullification theory, that there's an awesome irony in that.
If you buy into what he's saying, you effectively nullify the Constitution of the United States. Because he's basically saying that the framers did not have the right to do what they did. So the framers, rather than being heroes, are villains.
And he would say that multiple times, over and over again, every opportunity he got. The other issue with that just fascinates me with Garrison is we know that he angered the slaveholding Southern states. We know that. I mean, it makes common sense. Any abolitionist would draw the wrath of a good Georgian or Mississippian, you know, or even Virginian, for that matter. The part that's so ironic to me in looking at his life was the way he also angered the Northern business class, the people who controlled much of the economy, especially the shippings, the trade on the seas. They had a vested interest in keeping the South happy. And so here's Garrison, cutting loose with this vitriolic diatribe every chance he gets, and he's catching hell from the Southerners, but he's also incurring the wrath of his Northern brethren, who happen to be business leaders with these interests in keeping the trade routes for the cotton and the other products going. So the kind of moral courage, not even just courage,
right,
that it took to take that stand, it's hard for us to imagine today. On multiple occasions, he was attacked. His printing press was burned down. He was roped and tied to the back of a horse and dragged through the Boston Common, left for dead. On multiple occasions, he was attacked and physically beaten. Death threats, a common occurrence, and yet he persisted.
Michael, question. You mentioned the financial interests of business in terms of not wanting to confront what Garrison is saying, because it would have negatively affected business.
Right.
But I'm wondering about the extent to which the attacks and the physical beatings of Garrison speaks to something else that has nothing to do with business. In other words, I'm a working white man, or just an average common person, working person, farmer, whatever I might be, and I have my own prejudices, my own biases, and here's this man up there telling me that many of the things I don't really understand, but I've always believed. For example, that blacks, slaves are black because blacks innately ought to be slaves. I mean, if we need slaves, if we need people to do the work, these are the logical people to do it, because we all know that intellectually they're inferior, morally they're inferior, et cetera, et cetera. And now this guy is forcing me to confront my own deepest prejudices. I hate this guy.
Yeah, Jim Wallace of Sojourners coined a phrase that I liked. He said, America was founded upon the dual sins of the systematic enslavement of one race and the attempted genocide of another. And Wallace describes that as water to the goldfish. The goldfish doesn't know he's in water until he's out of it. It's just the presupposed environment. It's what's always been. And I think to this day, especially with racism, racism is endemic in our culture and our society. It's not just a historical reality, it's a current reality. Granted, we have made some strides forward, but I still believe that we're like that goldfish. Certainly, the people in Garrison's day, very few, had stepped back far enough in order to discern that this was a problem. And I do think he was hitting them with their own assumptions. Yep. I mean, he was certainly hitting the authors of the Declaration of Independence with their own words, and in essence saying, you hypocrites, you can't live up to even your own principles. It's tough. It's very, very tough when our sacred beliefs are challenged. And yet, as you say, Bill, that's exactly what
even when intellectually we know that our beliefs ought to be challenged.
Right.
We don't want to hear them. We don't want to deal face to face. I don't want to take this and bring it into the modern period.
I knew that was happening.
We're dealing with President Obama, and the attacks against President Obama border on vicious, on being vicious. And the way that some people are dealing with allegations that there might be some racism included in this attack because the President of the United States happens to be non-white, the way people deal with this and say, I know that there are people out there that think this is racist and it's not. And the fact of the matter is, are you talking about a level of racism, a kind of racism that's really difficult to define, let alone even see? But it's there. Is that what we're dealing with today? I mean, I can't tell you the number of people I say, hey, he's intellectual, he's one of the brightest guys, he's one of the best speakers I've ever had. But he's not what we think of when he's not presidential type. He shouldn't be president. But they can't put meaning on that. And I guess what I'm saying is that what we're talking about? Excuse me.
I hope not. But
I hope not too.
I fear it may be. I mean,
it's easy to scream that I am not a racist. But in fact, I believe things that I can't really explain any other way.
I think especially
to deny racism.
Especially for white males. I think it's important for all of us to acknowledge the fact that, like it or not, we are racist. We are privileged. We do enjoy benefits by virtue of being white males. We can intellectually argue that it ought not be that way, that we're trying to fight for a different kind of society. That still does not change what, in my opinion, is a sociological and ontological given in light of our history. It's a part of it. It's a part of me. It's a part of me that I have to fight against all the time. But there is a certain liberation when we can be confessional about those assumptions that we don't like about ourselves, that we have inherited. But when we confess that those are there, then I think that gives us a little more mobility, a little better handle on how we can begin to move past those things. I would hasten to add, however, that I don't believe all the attacks on President Obama are in most part racially motivated. I do believe that there are legitimate issues of concern that people on both sides of the aisle, regardless of political party, can raise and ought to be raising clearly. I'm not to suggest that anyone should be above critique, and I don't think President Obama would suggest that either. But there are some issues that move beyond racism. I mean, how long has it taken us to address the issue of homophobia in our society? And I think we're a long, long way from resolving those racial problems. And again, it gets back to Garrison's premise, this divine spark that we all have, this inner light, this divinity, if you will, that is a gift of God, and as children of God, we should acknowledge that for everyone, whether it be different sexual orientation, different genders, or different ethnicities. I don't think we've heard his message completely. You know, it's interesting, by the time Garrison, by the time the Civil War really breaks out, he starts to back off drastically in terms of some of his public pronouncements, and he starts working towards, he's assuming all along that the North's going to win, and this is going to be the death knell of slavery. And so he starts to pull back on some of that, but he doesn't lose that capacity for seeing equality of human beings as important. Because he immediately starts to pick up the women's suffrage issue.
He's involved in the Seneca Falls
absolutely
movement to a degree as well.
Right, yeah. Right. You know, he worked with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you know, all of those early women's rights advocates. He was right there on the podium with them, and that was, in fact, how he regained his relationship with Whittier and some of the others that he had alienated in his earlier, more radical years. It was through the women's suffrage movement that they rejoined sides.
I want to point out that Candace Vance in our chat room has a comment. She's telling us that she was talking about, you know, the issues of prejudice and things like that in her class just today, even down. So even many of these basic fundamental ideas that we're dealing with, she was dealing with in her classroom this very day. And so she wanted us to know that. And so she dropped us a message here.
I appreciate that. Thank you. You know, I was going to ask something, you know, and I'm thinking to the period of reform during this period when you mentioned Seneca Falls
I'm thinking Second Great Awakening and all, yeah.
Second Great Awakening and all of those things, and ultimately a period which becomes sensitive to the evils in society and the need to reform the evils of society suddenly confronts the most glaring evil of all, which is the institution. Are we dealing with a mentality that's very much like the 1960s was in this country? I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, the reason I'm saying that is because it's very hard to understand the reform era of the 1830s and 40s because it's 175 years ago. But it's very easy because we know people that lived through the 1960s that were, you know, anti-war and it belonged to SNCC and many of these other radical organizations in the civil rights movement in the 60s. And these were people that bought into the same views about humanity and about the fact that we're all one race and we all have this inner light. We're all God's children. And there's an element of the divine within all of us. It's almost like the rebirth of Emerson in a lot of ways. And I guess what I'm saying, the reason I ask that question is not so much for an answer, but it seems to me that a way to understand the 1830s and 40s is to try to remember the 1960s.
Yeah.
And accept for a moment the fact that many of the people in the 1960s who were screaming the loudest were not just troublemakers and spoiled brats out there because they didn't want to work or didn't want to study. They were people that really believed in what they were saying.
As my son always reminds me, I'm one of those old hippies that had the audacity to really believe that we could change the world.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you're talking about, the whole Age of Aquarius notion. Probably most of our listeners can identify with that because they probably weren't around like Keith.
Youngest guy here.
but I do believe that there was sort of an intentional righteousness about making change happen, a sense of empowerment that they could do that. I don't think it's by accident that the women's suffrage movement came right on the heels of this. And I think you make a good point, Bill, in that there are some real similarities about the sense of optimism. It's not naive.
No.
It's informed by a kind of spirituality, a kind of theology, a kind of ethic, understanding of this is our government, that we can change and redirect, that was a part of the 60s. But also, I believe, and, you know, getting back to our current president, I think that when Barack Obama was first elected, that there was an enormous resurgence in that kind of of optimism and hope, and perhaps it was unfair that no one person could live up to those sort of high expectations that many of us felt deep, deep in our heart. I remember at the night of the election and the camera scanning the crowd and that focused on Jesse Jackson, who was just weeping.
Yeah.
And you know, that was such a powerful moment for a lot of us, because it was almost like a sign that we were there. Well, you know, hello, we were not there.
And
we wanted to be there, but it was just another step in a very long journey that, as a society, we still have a huge mountain to climb. The problems of racism, of sexism, of homophobia, of the kinds of things that Garrison would take on, they do feel mountainous to us at times. But that's one of the reasons I like West Virginians. They're not afraid to climb a few mountains.
You know, the advantage of a primary source like this is there aren't many of us out there that have actually read and heard tonight, thanks to Michael, and heard the words of somebody who really believed in the optimism that a lot of us have read about in talk shows and various other things. And I think back to what we looked at in the course on the founders, and was it Emerson's statement
that
not one of the founders died happy, because the vision and the idealism that sparked independence in 1776, by the time you get when these people become old folks and begin to die off, they begin to realize that many of the things they thought that the revolution was about were visionary and illusionary and too idealistic and just weren't going to happen. And so they were, in many ways, as optimistic and as idealistic as Garrison is here. And to actually hear it and see it, hear the words of somebody who really is explaining. And the assumption is that if enough people, you're right, if enough people understand and hear this and appreciate it, if we get enough people believing in it, we're in the kind of society where we can actually make these things happen and turn bad things into good things.
And it did happen for Garrison. You know, I mean, he was able to survive the Civil War and live to see the 13th Amendment affirmed and made operative. But lest we think that he is not without his sophistry, that is to say, just an argument for the sake of making a good argument. He did believe it when he said it, and yet when the 13th Amendment was passed, he then started speaking of the Constitution in glorious terms as if it were the best thing since sliced bread that ever hit the human race. And I know he felt that then too, but one has to take his words with a somewhat of a grain of salt, at least in his prophetic moments, like the ones that I read, over against the successful accommodator once he sees that slavery has been abolished. But all in all, I don't think that there has been, there have been very few true prophets rise up in our society that could look Garrison in the eye and hold their own. Dr. King probably the exception to that, but and again, like I mentioned earlier, Mary Daly on the feminist front was just as effective, and in some ways more effective with her language than the rhetoric of Garrison. But the man was a prophet. He walked the talk. He put his life on the line. And I believe he played a huge hand in making sure that the war, this terrible civil war, would carry forth a moral implication that would change the society forever.
Uh-huh. Which is kind of interesting, because if you look at the debate that's taking place at Garrison's time, in Garrison's own day, Garrison is probably viewed by members of Congress, North and South, as being, a nut job or something like that, really a fringe element. They're seeing the debate, for the most part, in political or economic terms, not in moral terms whatsoever. And so he's really striking a chord that I think that it's kind of, in a way, he probably had a tremendous impact on the South. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Liberator was illegal mm-hmm. in Southern states. They even prevented post offices from delivering copies of it.
Yes, they did.
Think about that, which is, of course, they justified that on the basis of the idea of state authority over federal authority. And so, I mean, this has a lot of impact, and also in others to come. You think about Harriet Beecher Stowe and Uncle Tom's Cabin, in terms of getting people to see slavery as not just a political issue, not just a matter of who the senators are going to be, not just a matter of economics, even though there's clearly a huge economic factor here. I mean, if you own a textile factory in the North, whose cotton are you using? Is this something that he's really kind of getting to, isn't it?
Well, we obviously there's economic factors mm-hmm. to the issue of slavery. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's self-evident. I also would argue, however, and I think in the same spirit that Garrison argues, that budgets are moral documents. And I think that's something we've lost today. In the current debate about what we're going to do to resolve the budget, the federal budget.
Right.
I'm not hearing people talk about the moral implications of those decisions. That budget, however it shakes out, whether it's through this super committee or through some other means, carries with it societal and ethical implications that make it a moral document or an immoral document, depending upon your metaphysic or your
right,
ethic.
Exactly.
And I think it's one thing to suggest that economics is important. Certainly economics is important. But I still don't think, no matter how you argue the point, even if you're arguing from a Marxist assumption, there are still moral, ethical implications to those decisions, and that needs to be front and center in the debate today, and I don't hear it.
So you're saying we need a William Lloyd Garrison?
Desperately.
We need somebody, we need a moral conscience.
Or we need to reawaken the moral conscience of the people.
Let me introduce the fact that in some ways we have one, and it's the Tea Party. And what I mean is they basically stand for certain principles that they obviously will not compromise, and they've required commitments from candidates, Republican candidates, that they will not, under any circumstances, raise taxes. And the question that I'm raising, which is tied in with this, is the issue of the moral question versus the issue of the benefits of the need to compromise. Mm-hmm. It's obvious from Garrison's speech that there's no basis on which any of this is, to him, is negotiable. This is truth.
Yeah, there's no compromise.
There's no compromise here. You either agree with this or you're part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And so, basically, the people who would get together and formulate the Missouri Compromise or the Compromise of 1850, or any of these other compromises, to Garrison, as he says right here, in doing that, you're compromising evil. You're basically condoning sin as being legitimate. And so it raises the whole question about our political system as being one based on negotiation and compromise versus the moral question of right and wrong. If you insert too much morality into the debate, do you make it impossible to hold the union together?
Morality is not inevitable. Morality is not the same as an absolute truth claim. I want to challenge the statement about the Tea Party that it's a moral position to say we will not raise taxes. I think it is blatantly an amoral position. It's neither moral nor immoral. It is a tax statement that does not consider the impact of that position on people who are vulnerable in our society. That's what makes it a moral question. When one asks, how are the poor, the outcast, the sick, the weak in our society, how are they going to be impacted by this budget decision? Then that budget becomes a moral document. To simply say, yes tax, no tax, is not a moral decision. That's an amoral decision. It becomes immoral when we say we will intentionally establish a policy that we know is going to hurt those who can take it the least, and that is the weakest in our society. That's why I think that we need to raise the moral question far above the amoral positions of the Tea Party today. That's just my opinion.
That's fine. Well, no, and let me be a little bit of devil's advocate here, but we were talking in Keith's quote earlier
from
Calhoun.
Yeah, I was thinking exactly that. Yeah.
And Calhoun's idea that slavery is a positive good. Would Calhoun have ever had to make that claim if Garrison hadn't made his claim? And once Garrison makes his claim, and then Calhoun responds with his claim, have we reached the point where there's no solution possible?
Calhoun didn't start the debate. Calhoun's position was well established long before Calhoun was even born.
Okay.
Garrison is responding to a prior evil. I come back to Wallace's claim that the United States was a country founded upon the systematic enslavement of one race and the attempted genocide of another. That precedes Garrison. Garrison is reacting against an establishment that had roots far, far.
Right.
Well, I'm not telling you anything.
But what I'm saying, though, is that what Garrison is doing is forcing people into extreme positions. and making compromise less likely, if not impossible.
Well, that was the argument of the Northern business class, as I was referencing earlier. Right. They were saying, by you saying this, flying off the handle and saying these radical things, you are pushing the South into secession. And civil war is going to come, and then our business is not going to thrive because of that. So they were wanting them to shut up.
It's obvious from what Garrison says in this speech that to his way of thinking, slavery is so evil that if it comes to a civil war, it's worth it because it's being fought to eliminate an evil.
Yes.
That's the ultimate goal. That's the ultimate prize or the ultimate good.
Right.
Is to destroy an evil. So the preservation of, and of course, once you get into the preservation of society being more important than this, or whether in fact it is more important, then you get into the questions of the Catholic Church and child abuse, and was it more important for the Church to preserve the institution than it was to protect the children? And the reason I'm raising these questions is because I think these are the kinds of questions that this stuff raises.
Right. It does. I mean, and implicit in much of, not in this speech, but in some of the other writings that Garrison put out there, was an implied just war theory. And he, I would think, on a couple of different occasions, he wrote about just war theory as a response to the Northern criticism that his Northern business class people, critics, were leveling against him, that there are occasions when morality demands action that, yes, can be horrible, but it is a just struggle to undertake. I think he saw this evolving, coming cataclysm that we call the Civil War as if it comes, as much a punishment from God for our sins of maintaining this system as it does from the evil of slavery itself. This is that transcendentalism coming through. That spirituality that says, you know, there are some overarching forces at play that we might contemplate, meditate on, but we're not going to be able to overcome them if we persist in evil. And that seems to be a part of his consciousness. But just war, you know, he doesn't spend a lot of time talking about it, but I think it's implicit in a lot of what he says. I want to come back to this issue, though, about forcing people into extreme positions. The prophetic movement in America.
Kind of playing right into your strength a little bit.
I don't know if it's my strength.
This is where you shine.
The prophetic movement, meaning those who muster the moral, spiritual courage to speak truth to power. I'm not talking about predicting the future. I'm talking about being prophetic, standing for something over against something else. Prophetic movements themselves are always controversial and polarizing. You know, it's been that way if you look back through the major prophets of the Old Testament. It's always a polarization effect. And I don't want to sound too Hegelian here, but sometimes it's in creating that thesis, antithesis, that you can evolve into a new higher synthesis. Sometimes it can come into a worse synthesis too, and that's what I'm afraid we're heading for right now politically. But that's a different story. But being prophetic per se means that you are a provocateur. You know, when Gandhi was engaged in a protest and he was questioned by the press, what happens if the government doesn't respond? He said, "Well, we'll find another way. We'll provoke again until they do respond." So there's a role in the prophetic movement to create that sort of polarization for the sake, however, of being clear about what our choices need to be beyond this polarization. And today, when I look at the political deep freeze, this paralysis that we seem to be caught in Washington, I think we need the prophetic vision that can get us beyond just the red and the blue states, and to begin to see some sort of new synthesis emerging. Frankly, and Bill, you know, since you're a big fan of the Tea Party, you may not appreciate this, but I see the Occupy Wall Street movement as an attempt to move the discussion beyond the old Republican-Democrat dialogue into an economic discussion, an empowerment discussion that is of a different nature than the old debate that we seem to be locked into in our established parties. So I do think the prophetic's there, and I do think you still have that reaction. I don't want to hear that. People want to believe that, you know, we're in good shape. Well, we're not. You know, what does it say when 1% of the population controls nearly 70% of the net worth of the country? It says there is a fundamental inequality, which brings us right back to William Lloyd Garrison. When you have that, you're going to have an unjust society. William Sloan Coffin once said, he's talking about revolutions, and he said, revolutions never occur without pre-existing revolting conditions. When people are oppressed and victimized and feel helpless, that's when revolutions happen. And what has yet to be, the jury's still out on what's going to happen next in our national discourse. But I think there are a lot of people, and it's not just young people. It's not like the 60s. You know, you go to one of those rallies and you'll see folks my age and older, and you'll see young folks. You'll see all sorts of, you know, it's a real diversity movement. And I think they're trying to point to a way beyond the paralysis.
Garrison spoke to people who responded to the truth of what he was saying by attacking him physically. Official America, the official institutions of the United States, are dealing with the Occupy Wall Street movement with tear gas and various other things. That's the way they're dealing with the truth that the Occupy Wall Street movement is presenting. And what we're talking about is free speech as exercised by the powerless, by those without power.
Now, there's a lot of speech exercised by the powerful, too. But what these guys are doing is they're showing the kind of moral courage in the face of that kind of abuse, like we saw at UC Davis and, you know, the other day with the pepper spray. That is stirring, in my opinion, across the country, a new awakening to the moral dignity of these protesters' position. It's horrible to watch those kids getting sprayed in the face with pepper spray, and yet they stood there and took it. They took it because what they believed in was worth it. And that can have a contagious effect, a powerful effect, and sort of that 100th monkey syndrome that we used to talk about. You know, there seems to be in society a critical mass, that when a critical mass is established and caught up in a vision, change happens.
Michael, and I know that it's not fair to lay a straight history question on you, so maybe I'll throw this at
you. Okay.
But basically, I guess what I'm saying is that would Garrison believe that everything we did leading up to secession itself which were the compromises, the elements of the compromise of 1850, the Missouri Compromise, and many of the compromises that were made during the Constitutional Convention. I've been thinking through those as you were speaking tonight. Garrison would say that those are rather insignificant issues because they really are dodges. They don't really get to the critical issue. Critical issue is, right, the evil of the institution. And any compromise that you make with that evil is evil.
Yeah. I would also point to the Seward document, which is part of their readings as well. When Seward, in response to Calhoun does basically say, kind of takes that opposite polarized view, you know, the South can't compromise anymore. Not maintain its honor. Not with safety and honor, the South cannot compromise. That equilibrium was destroyed that was originally there when the Union was created. Well, Seward points out that there never really was an equilibrium, that in fact there were more slave states at the beginning of the United States than free states. And he says there's a higher law. There's a higher law than the Constitution. There's something more important in the sense that Seward, I think, is kind of intimating that what we need to do is find a way to peacefully end slavery. We need to bring this to him. We need to get to the actual heart of the problem. Maybe not quite in the same way the Garrison would approach it, but I would certainly point to the Seward document to kind of play off of Garrison in that sense. You seem to react to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, John Greenleaf Whittier was another one of the folks that Garrison wrote with for
yeah,
a while.
Right.
And Whittier was of the opinion that we need to address slavery through the mechanisms of government. So he spent a lot of time writing and lobbying, you know, senators and congressmen about the issue. And for a while, Garrison bought into that strategy. He said, okay, that's good. You know, was it the Liberty Party that later
became
the Free Soil Movement?
Free Soil Party.
For a while, Garrison seemed persuaded that that had legitimacy, but I think he grew impatient. I think he saw that gradualism was not going to really make the ultimate change that he was looking for. And that's when he and Whittier made their break, and their friendship lasted for another 15 years before they would.
Do you have any idea how Garrison reacted to, because I do not know, how Garrison reacted to John Brown, the Brown raid in October 1859?
I do not.
I wonder. I just wonder. You know,
my guess is that he probably would give Brown his blessing. That would be my guess. Certainly, people who did bless what Brown did were friends of Garrison.
Thoreau
was Frederick Douglass. There were some others, and there wasn't a huge "Oh, don't do this, John" movement, you know. So there can be some issues there. But there's one other big one here that we haven't talked about that,
right,
I think is really important. And it comes back to, again, Jim Wallace's statement about the systematic enslavement of one race and the attempted genocide of another. One of the criticisms that some folks have leveled against Garrison is the near silence on the issue of the Native Americans.
Yeah.
How can this man hold such passionate, prophetic zeal for the slaves and yet be so silent on the expropriation of the Native Americans that was going on during this time? You know, we were talking earlier how people sort of think that nothing else was happening during the Civil War.
Right.
You know, it was just up until Appomattox Courthouse, everything else stopped. Well, it didn't. Certainly, you know, with Jackson, the era of Jackson, you know, the Trail of Tears, all these things were going on and were quite evident that that an entire people were being expropriated and attempted genocide. You can't call it anything else. And yet, you know, I've looked, and I can't see many references to that issue as being front and center in Garrison's thought or his writings. Maybe it's there, and I just haven't seen it. Maybe some of the folks out there.
Somebody has. I can't think of a single reference myself. We were talking about this before the program.
Right.
It's just, yeah, you know, it's kind of a stunning absence of evidence, I guess we might say.
And it's only when you take him seriously that you see the gap, that you see that is missing. That ought to be there. If you're going to give Garrison his due and say he was absolutely committed to what he was saying, then Native Americans should have been in his...
Yeah, I mean, it
which would really fit in also with the influence of the Quakers that you mentioned earlier, too, as well. And of course, I mean, after the First Great Awakening, the Quakers essentially eliminated slavery from their ranks. And I think that the Quaker petition is really the last public act of Benjamin Franklin, that he actually, you know, lends his support to that, which, of course, is a petition to abolish slavery. And I think Madison plays a major role in terms of tabling it in the House of Representatives. I'm trying to look for confirmation there.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, Joseph Ellis mentions that heavily in his book Founding Brothers. And, of course, his whole thing is, in terms of slavery, that the framers had a conspiracy of silence. Conspiracy of silence. Garrison wouldn't agree with that. He would say they spoke loud and clear.
Absolutely.
That the Constitution does mention, and the Constitution does mention slavery. It doesn't use the word slave. I've always thought that was interesting. Persons held to service or labor, it uses euphemisms. But when you, like anybody writes on that question about the Confederate Constitution, persons held to service or labor is not in the Confederate Constitution. The word slave is in the Confederate Constitution. It's much more straightforward. Something kind of along these lines. I mean, one of the primary elements in which the Constitution reinforced the authority of slave owners was obviously the Fugitive Slave Clause. I think in Article 4. Coming out of the Compromise of 1850, what really enabled Douglas primarily to get that compromise through. Clay tried the omnibus bill, and Douglas broke it up and was able to get large elements of the measures through, though Calhoun opposed them. He's getting ready to die. He has this speech, which is read by James Mason of Virginia, though Seward opposes it. You got people on both sides opposing it. Really, I think the crucial factor in terms of passing the Compromise of 1850 was the Fugitive Slave Law, to use federal authority to, of course, recover fugitive slaves, which, from the Southern point of view, from the point of view of Southern slave owners, and especially planters in the United States Senate, that was basically fulfilling your promise in terms of the Constitution. Okay, go ahead.
Oh. Yeah, gentlemen, I just thought I would did a quick search, and in regard to Garrison's response to John Brown, the following.
Okay.
In the Liberator, he published a column stating that Brown's raid was well-intended, but sadly misguided. He referred to it as an enterprise wild and futile, but then went on and sort of created some wiggle room by saying, and this is a quote, "Whenever commenced, I cannot but wish success to all slave insurrections."
Right. Which is a chilling statement south of the Mason-Dixon line,
yes.
Right? And, of course, Brown, you know, really encouraged the creation of militia units and all that. So, I mean, thank you, Bob. The wonders of the World Wide Web, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Right? And I noticed that...
Instantaneous research.
I noticed that you can be talking in class, you can be lecturing and kind of wonder something out loud, and a student is more than willing to look that up for you
at that particular moment.
Maybe you can find something on the Native American question.
You never know, right? But, but in terms of the fugitive slave law, which I've always thought is an interesting juxtaposition in terms of positions North and South, the South always talking about states' rights and the emphasis on state authority. In this case, in this instance, wants to use federal authority. The North responds with state authority. You know, the drafting and passing of liberty laws, personal liberty laws in the North, Ohio in particular, does this. To me, the fugitive slave law should have played right into Garrison's hands, because here you bring slavery home to the North. It's not something that simply happened in the South. In Massachusetts, in Boston, Anthony Burns is dragged through the streets in chains, right? And it costs a tremendous amount of money to send him back to Virginia and back into slavery. I think the South recovered like 300 fugitive slaves under that law. But as a public relations, matter, it was a debacle. It was a nightmare, right? Because they had to convert, you know, thousands of people into a more abolitionist position than even before. It had to. I mean, a lot of people oppose slavery for various reasons. There are people who oppose slavery out of racism. Mm-hmm. They oppose slavery because they didn't like slaves. They didn't want black people in the country. Right? Period. Colonization. Right? Those kinds of things. And so, do you know anything about Garrison and the fugitive slave law? I can imagine some of the situations that he might have gotten involved in terms of that.
He should have been totally opposed to the fugitive slave law.
Certainly.
Because the fallout of it became an engine
exactly
to protect the institution of slavery. And that was
exactly
ultimately that's what he's criticizing.
Yeah, and so what I'm saying is what happened is with the fugitive slave law, Frederick Douglass said that, you know, that every slave catcher who meets his bloody end in this business is a testament to the manhood of our race, right? And so what you had was violence, right? You had shootouts. So like in Christiana, Pennsylvania, there was a shootout between a slave owner and his son and, you know, people who are trying to keep them from securing these fugitives and bringing them back into slavery. And so there's a lot of violence that takes place as a result of the fugitive slave law in Ohio near Oberlin College. Some of the students of Oberlin College actually intervened to prevent a slave catcher and a federal marshal from, you know, literally capturing a fugitive slave. You got to remember that, you know, when they would bring this individual before a judge, the way the law was written, the judge was paid $15 if he determined that individual was a fugitive slave. He was paid $10 if he determined that individual was a free black. And it was justified on the basis that it would require more paperwork to send a fugitive slave back south into slavery. And so this is something, you know, that really had to turn a lot of people in the North probably more around to what Garrison was saying. In some way, I mean, it's not something that you read about or hear about that's happening in South Carolina. You see someone captured. You see someone dragged away. You see someone treated in this fashion. And I know that abolitionists in New England took special care to try to help even free blacks move to Canada.
Exactly.
At this time, because of the fear that they would actually be kidnapped and return to slavery, right? Which, you know, ironically, I mean, during the war itself, during the Gettysburg campaign, the 17th Virginia Cavalry, which was from this area, the commander from Cabell County, Albert Gallatin Jenkins, part of its task during the Gettysburg campaign was actually to round up fugitives, send them back into slavery. So, I mean, that was official policy of the Confederate government, you know, during the war itself. So I just kind of wonder about Garrison and the fugitive slave law and all these kinds of controversies that had to emerge. I imagine the Liberator was filled with that. I don't know if the Liberator, imagine you can read maybe the Liberator online. I mean, I know you can, like New York Times, even old articles of it. Harper's Weekly is all available in that sense. That might be something to look into in terms of that.
Keith, from your experience, and Michael, too, I'm thinking about Lincoln here. I'm thinking about the Lincoln Douglas.
Right.
Specifically. How close does Lincoln ever get as close to Garrison?
No.
Never. Okay. What, how close does he get?
The closest that I would place him to it, he does say that Lincoln would say and did say on occasions, on several occasions, that if slavery was not wrong, then nothing was wrong. But Lincoln was a self-professed white supremacist, as, you know, most 19th century political figures were, you know, and you can read, and you can see this in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. I mean, very often, it's kind of interesting. When I look at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, what Lincoln says in one town is not what he says in another town. And you look at a map of Illinois, and it helps you out. He says something different in southern Illinois than he does in northern Illinois. You look at Illinois. Illinois, the southern part of the state, is almost in the south, right? So, in fact, after I think one of the initial debates in the north, Stephen Douglas looks at him after the debate and says, I'm going to take you down to Egypt. Because they refer to southern Illinois as Egypt. So I'm going to take you down to Egypt. I think Douglas is probably more straightforward in terms of his positions.
Does it happen then that the South's position that secession is based on the rights of the states to secede and the compact theory and all of that? Lincoln's position is that his principal responsibility is to preserve
the Union.
Is arguing on either side about the war from the perspective of the Union, is that really a dodge? Does that really not get to the real issue, which is where Garrison is? In other words, you know, as the debate moves towards war itself,
right?
Do we see this kind of moral position disappear from the debate, and it becomes almost a law and order debate, like you would see on Law and Order, like in a courtroom, where you know it's almost like dueling attorneys between Lincoln and Douglas,
right?
And what they're debating theory and all that stuff, but they're not really getting.
Well, you know, Lincoln and Douglas, Lincoln's trying to get elected, and it's a very, very narrow electorate that he's appealing to, because, you know, United States senators are elected by state legislatures until the 20th century, until the Progressive Era. That's the case. And so what he's trying to do is make sure he gets votes to get into the United States Senate. At the same time, Douglas is also trying to make sure that he is going to be appealing enough to the South that he might possibly get the Democratic nomination in 1860, and he doesn't quite accomplish that because of the Dred Scott case. Expansion is the key thing, right? In terms of the political debate, expansion is the key thing. Whenever you add new states, that's the issue. The Southern position, as it develops, is that we fought the Mexican-American War just as much as the North. In fact, we probably supported it more. It was a Southern president, James K. Polk, that oversaw it. You know, we were heavily involved and provoked it. Had the declaration of war in the desk.
Exactly.
You know,
before it happened,
provoked the occurrence, and Lincoln stood upon the floor of the House of Representatives and said, "Where on American soil has American blood been shed?" Because the message for asking for the declaration claimed that American blood had been shed on American soil. And that territory is very disputed between Texas and Mexico at that particular point anyway. And that kind of gets me away from where was I going with this. So the Southern position was the territory belonged to all the states, free or slave. Therefore, since the Constitution protects slavery, which Garrison agrees that it does, And they agree that it does. Therefore, we should have equal access. You cannot deny us access to the territories. You cannot deny us and our property, our slaves, access to the territories. That's the southern position. The northern position is, yes, we can. We have. The Northwest Ordinance did so. In a sense that those, what we think was American Midwest, you're not going to have slavery in those states. When those territories become states, slavery will not be there. The Missouri Compromise did that, saying with the 36-30 line, there will be no slavery in states above that line except for Missouri, carved out of what was the Louisiana Purchase. Now, there is a compromise position, and Stephen Douglas really represents that position. And that position is popular sovereignty. Let them decide for themselves. But that produces a debate, because when do they decide? Douglas is under the impression that a territory can decide. But Southerners argue, no, you must be a state. If you must be a state, that gives slavery a chance to become entrenched. And that's why the Kansas-Nebraska Act is such a huge problem, because you're basically nullifying the Missouri Compromise. And therefore, abolitionists in the North are funneling people into Kansas. There's like 2,000 people eligible to vote for the first territorial election. 6,000 people vote. And most of those extra voters are from Missouri, the slave state. And the Pierce administration recognizes that territorial government, you know, that's elected in that election. Pierce is a good example of a dough face. I mean, he's a Pennsylvania. I mean, he's not Pennsylvania. He's from New Hampshire. He's a Northerner, but he takes Southern positions. The dominant figure in his cabinet was Jefferson Davis, his Secretary of War. And so Douglas's position is that a territory can decide to do that. Southern position is, no, only a state could abolish slavery. Only a state can do that. But that would give slavery a chance to entrench. The Dred Scott decision, which, you know, has a lot of implications, obviously what Taney says about the idea that blacks cannot be citizens is something you read in textbooks, but the thing that was really impactful at the time and what you really see in the Lincoln-Douglas debates is the idea that it takes a southern position in terms of the territories. It's saying Congress has no right. Congress has no right to regulate, you know, slavery in the territories. Which, you know, for a lot of people in the North, and someone like Lincoln in particular, this is a conspiracy, right? They're trying to control the government. They're trying to make sure that slavery can be anywhere. And he does say those kinds of things in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. He does make that, say those kinds of things in terms of that debate. And so expansion is like crucial in terms of the tensions. And you throw things like Brown in. Oh, my goodness. Everybody got to the point where they couldn't compromise. I mean, you were talking about the value of compromise. No, Garrison's not someone in favor of compromise. Neither is John C. Calhoun, right? Neither was John C. Calhoun. And it got to the point where no one's going to be willing to compromise. You can't compromise anymore.
But Michael was talking about Garrison going through an evolutionary process,
yeah,
that he began as much,
right,
more moderate.
Okay, I think you're right about Lincoln in that sense,
and
in a way.
And so did Calhoun. I mean, Calhoun, Calhoun
was a nationalist.
Was a nationalist, exactly.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he basically was making the arguments later in his life, mm-hmm, that he never would have dreamed, he would have saw as treason.
Right.
In the early part of his political life. And
he flip-flopped.
Yes. Before, we've got
We got like 10 minutes. Yeah.
And Keith, before, because this is kind of, is there anything that we need to touch on before we leave tonight that we haven't touched on yet that you think? I haven't had a discussion like this.
This has been great. And
yeah.
I learned something about Garrison, and I tell Michael, I'm going to give you a lot of credit here. Maybe pat myself on the back, right? Or it was a good idea to bring in Michael. In thinking about Garrison myself in my own teaching, I usually thought about Garrison in a literary sense as the publisher and editor of a newspaper, not really as an orator or anything of that nature. And I think that's a point that you've made that I think that we can all benefit from in terms of our teaching, is how we can use his words and kind of see it in context of him delivering that, saying those kinds of things before an audience of people, and how much nerve he had. And, you know, it's very, you know, it's very admirable. And also, I mean, in terms of how you teach, and I'm going to ask you this, Michael, in terms of how you teach, do you use the method of reading documents or reading things in character quite a bit in your teaching? And you find that quite effective?
You got to be careful. You can overdo it.
Yeah.
You know, teaching a cultural anthropology class and people can't figure out if it's anthropology or if it's theater.
Right, yeah.
So you got to be careful with it. A little bit will go a long way. But when you have a character like Garrison, and there are others, talking about them is just not the same thing as getting inside that person and trying to bring those words to life. It's not for everybody. You know, not everybody's as big a ham as I am.
Right.
I guess that's why I'm also a preacher.
Right.
But it is effective. The last thing I'll say, and then I'll shut up. The one thing I always try and bring home with my classes and my students, and regardless of whether it's a psychology class or an anthropology class or a philosophy class, is when we deal with an issue like oppression, which is right at the core of what Garrison was about, I always try to bring it back home. I always try to speak of it in terms of, here we are in southern West Virginia. We, in many ways, are heirs of this particular time.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I always talk about the southern part of the state that sided largely with the Confederacy.
Definitely.
That after the war returned home, they didn't have pension money like the Yankees had, nor did we have Reconstruction funds like the secessionist states
right.
had. So from the very beginning, we were a black hole. Mm-hmm. We were prime for carpetbaggers to come in and buy us up and exappropriate us. To this day, according to the ARC, 71% of the land in West Virginia is owned and operated by out-of-state interests.
Right.
81% of the mineral rights are. With numbers like that, we should be called a colony,
yeah.
And rightly so. And it comes directly from this era,
yeah.
This time in history. And so when I talk about this era, I always try and remind people, guys, we are really living with the consequences of decisions that were made by these people. And that's why we're caught in these cycles of poverty that we can't seem to break from. This is, it started then, and we're still living with it today. So I always try to bring that lesson back in sort of a contemporary existential kind of context for them.
One of the things that I've thought of two or three times during our conversation tonight, which is a little bit beyond the scope of where we are this evening, is the 14th Amendment and the issues of corporations, the Supreme Court.
Persons.
Corporations
yeah.
are persons.
Yeah.
People. And every time the issue came up about slaves being property, and then you look at our legal documents, our Constitution, and basically, once you can define slaves as property, that gives you a whole series of options under the Constitution, which are legal and legitimate. Once you basically determine that corporations are persons under our Bill of under our First Amendment,
and their money is free speech,
Money is free speech, then you open up a whole set of options which allow the kinds of things that you've been just talking about.
Not only
to
do you,
happen.
Not only do you open it up, you close off a lot.
Yeah.
With the Buckley Amendment, when speech is something that's purchased, then free speech, in my opinion, takes a huge backseat because those who have money are going to do the speaking.
Yeah.
And there's a silencing effect on the younger side of American history. And I think the Buckley Amendment feeds right into that. And it's very similar to what happened in West Virginia.
A couple of weeks ago, Keith and I were involved in this We the People debate mm-hmm. series with local high schools. And one of the issues that I was in the session on the Bill of Rights, and basically what we were looking at were the rights of free speech and the right to assemble, those freedoms specifically. And we were talking with the students, and one of the issues that came up, and one of the students raised it actually, the responsibility in looking at the whole issue of free speech and the right to speak, vis-a-vis the issue of money and the fact that it speaks louder than people without money. And her point was, which I thought was very good, that in order to really understand the right of freedom of speech, you really have to understand the responsibility of the listener as well as the rights of the speaker. And basically, as citizens, we all have a responsibility to listen to speech and to hear speech. I thought that was just a profound statement. Mm-hmm. And it's not all, because if you basically put all of the onus on the freedom to speak, then the person that has the most money speaks the loudest, so to speak. But if you basically reflect on the fact that it's part of a citizen's responsibility to listen to as many different points of view on a particular issue as possible, then you begin to realize that that basically weakens the power of money to speak louder than those people who don't have it can speak. And I thought it was a profound issue.
I think Bob's trying to get a word in edgewise here. So let's, you have a question or comment?
I'm probably out of order, but it struck me that since there was mention of John Brown, you know, Friday will be the 152nd anniversary of his execution. Mm-hmm. And a few minutes, and Dr. Bill, you're talking about free speech versus paid speech versus, you know, what constitutes that freedom. And earlier you were talking, Dr. Curry, about what happened at UC Davis. I just ran across these remarks from John Brown upon his conviction.
Yeah.
And this is pertinent to questions we are answering today. He said, talking about the raid on Harper's Ferry,
mm-hmm.
had I interfered in the manner in which I admit, and which I admit has been fairly proved, had I so interfered on behalf of the rich, the powerful, yeah. the intelligent, the so-called great, or in behalf of any of their friends, either father, mother, brother, sister, wife, or children, or any of that class, you know, we call them the 1% now, and suffered and sacrificed what I have in this interference, it would have been all right, and every man in this court would have deemed it an act worthy of reward rather than punishment. Wow.
Amen.
It's also fascinating how quickly they executed John Brown, right? The raid took place in October, and John Brown was not executed for treason against the United States. John Brown was executed for treason against Virginia. He was tried by Virginia and executed by Virginia, and so that's not lost, not lost at all at that particular time.
It's really interesting because our next chat, which is going to be on the 6th.
Yeah, which is just next Tuesday.
These things are coming pretty fast and furious. But one of the things that I was thinking about this evening in terms of next week is looking at the debate over the Constitution between Federalists and Anti-Federalists,
mm-hmm.
and what kind of assumptions you would have to make in order to take the context that we've been talking about tonight and apply it to that debate. And ultimately what the Federalists had to do is basically suggest that if the Constitution was not ratified, then ultimately the Union would be destroyed and all our freedoms with them. And so, in other words, it would be the end of the world if the Constitution was not destroyed. Once you buy that thinking, then you can make the kinds of compromises that Garrison is so critical of here.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting as you begin to play with theory and apply it in different circumstances, in different situations. And it would seem to me, for our teachers out there, that the more we can get youngsters into these real-life roles and begin to apply these things to things that they understand. I point out the term PRISM, West Virginia, here. The extent to which we try to basically deal with something our youngsters can understand in order to introduce the things that they haven't heard of before, maybe. And it's the same. I think Michael makes the point about West Virginia's economy and the problems we've been in now. That's having their origins right during this period with the decisions that are being made.
West Virginia's born in this period.
We are at just about 9 o'clock, and I'm wondering, Keith, is there anything else?
No, I do want to thank Michael. I want to thank you for coming by. I appreciate it. Michael's always been real good to me. I was laying in a hospital bed one time a year or so ago, and Michael called me up. He made sure that he knew that he wanted me to know that he was thinking.
Number.
No, it wasn't a wrong number. He was wanting to help me out, as you did as well. So I've always appreciated Michael Curry, and I always will. So yeah,
I appreciate that. Thanks for having me, guys. It was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. It's great to see you again. And Bob, thank you, Agnes. Thank you so much for the setup. Had a great time, always do. When we go in, I don't know what's going to happen. And when we come out, I wonder where the time was.
Exactly.
So I don't know what that means. But thank you. All thank right. you very much, guys.
All right, we'll see him next Tuesday, right?
Yep.
You've been listening live on the Horn, America's liberal voice, to another PRISM West Virginia American History Chat. Your hosts have been Dr. Bill O'Brien and Professor Keith Lilly. Join us again Tuesday, December the 6th, 2011, as we continue this inquiry into America's founding and its growth into the 19th century. This is The Horn.